Two questions. What themes have we considered, and what do they tell us about the purpose and method of the author in this book? So let's think through this together just a moment. What themes have we considered, and what do they tell us about the purpose and method of the author in the book? Yes. Okay, so we have looked at the phrase under the sun as a frequently recurring theme in the book, and or frequently recurring word, which means it's a theme. And what does that tell us about the author's purpose and method in the book?
From the perspective of the world, our perspective, what we see
from here. Okay, so it's life on this earth, apart from God, in a sense of the reality of things spiritual and eternal, life under the sun. Another theme. What else have we looked at? Yes?
Vanity.
Okay, vanity. Another word that occurs often. And what does that tell us about what the author is trying to do in this book? Okay. The futility and pointlessness of life apart from God. Now, the apart from God is in parenthesis because that's not overt, as we've noticed, but but it is certainly part of the theme. What else? Yes.
I have seen,
and what does that tell us about where the author is coming from? Right, so it's observations in this whole scientific point of view. I'm only talking about what I can see and observe and measure. And the contrary to that would be, I have seen versus faith. Okay, what else? Two more. Yes. Right. Grasping for the wind, chasing after the wind. And what is that? What is the author? What does that signify about the author's intent or purpose?
Very much related to vanity, futility.
Well, I hope it's related. Right. These all fit together. And exactly. It's wind. And it's the right. So the search, the pursuit, and the end is nothing when you grasp it. There's nothing there. And then the last one was profit, which is kind of the opposite of vanity. What is the net benefit? And where does it all take you? Nowhere. Our theme today is references to God in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, think about it, what all is being said, what the author is trying to do in this book, and how he goes about it. I mean, what would you think? What might you expect to find regarding God in Ecclesiastes? Now, you have the advantage. You've already looked at it and studied this and searched it all out. But trying to pull yourself back, given all of this, I mean, what would you expect the author to be saying about God? How would he be treating the subject, given all those things? Yeah. Okay. Okay?
Well, since he's focused on what he's seeing when he talks about God, maybe the separateness of God from what he's experiencing here.
Right. That's interesting, because all of this is about life here. So kind of the otherness of God, that he's separate from his creation. Is that what you're saying? That's good. That's a good observation. Any other thoughts here?
Well, some of it is he deals with God. For example, like when he talked about a man and his wife, he said, that's a gift from God. Some of those things in life that we find that are good, they're the things that came from God.
Right, but that's not... So my question really is, without really looking as to what he says and does, if you take this as your starting point, that he's talking, this the whole book is about life as separate from God and eternal realities and spiritual things and all that. And he's trying to make the point that life is empty and meaningless as apart from God. I mean, when I hear that, I have a picture as to what he would be saying and how he would be talking about God. Now, maybe it's just me, I don't know. But the reality is, when I look at this book, it's very jarring because it's totally not what I would expect. Eric.
Yeah, judging from that, you would think that God would be referring to God in terms of his judgment, his wrath upon man for living this way, and also a clear call to repent.
Right, right. And I think that's an excellent observation. Yes?
I think that God is more impersonal. I mean, everything is made, life is empty, we're just here. So if there is a God, he's really not actively involved. It's not what he means.
Right. To fit with his whole approach. Excuse me, I'm losing it. And then that's what I would think. Or the other thing that I would think, that he really wouldn't talk that much about God. I mean, if everything he's saying is that, you know, life just goes on and it's this great big cycle, you just twirl around in circles and you're going nowhere, I wouldn't expect him to say that much about God. Or if I did, he would not be personal, he would not be involved. Or perhaps, as Eric points out, that he's the judge, ready to hold you accountable, ready to judge. And that's not exactly what we find when we delve into the book. So let's take a look at this and then come back and form some conclusions and evaluations. Now, what we want to do is get us plenty of space here. So we're going to go through and look, thank you, at the occurrences and references to God through this book. And we want to note what terms are used for God. And we'll note those as we go along. We want, in the second place, to look at actions God takes. In other words, what does God do? It's talking about God in Ecclesiastes. We're going to look at what they call him, and then what the author says this God does. And then in the third place, and this will be kind of, we kind of go through this, and at the end, we've got to step back and look at who is this God? Roles of God, or what is his view of God? So kind of ask yourself that question as we're working our way through here. What's he really saying? What kind of God is this? Who is this God? And that will become quite obvious as we look at the actions that God takes. Now, let's work our way through here. Does anybody have some of these references? What's the first place where God is mentioned in the book of Ecclesiastes? Yes. 113. And what does it say there? Well, go ahead and read that for us, please.
It is the greatest work which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with.
So what does it say that God does or has done there? Exactly. God has given. And we're going to find that God has, this phrase is used 10 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. Very interesting, very important. When we talk about what God does, this is the most frequently used, frequently referred to action of God. Also talks about the hand of God and the gift of God, and there's a few more in addition to the 10. So this is pretty important. What is it? What's he saying? He says that it is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. What's he saying? Right. Yeah, I didn't understand what you were saying. But so he's talking about the futility of life, the ceaseless pursuit, you know, chasing your tail, running around in a circle, you know, the waters flow into the sea and then they come back again and all of this. and God and man's in the middle of it, and his life is occupied with such vanity and going in these endless circles. That's the task. That's where man has been set. But do you? He could have just said that. He could have said, "Wow, what a deal man's got himself into! Wow, look at what humanity, at the vanity that humanity is immersed in." And that's true, but that's not what he says. And this is the kind of thing I find remarkable in this book. He says it is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. In other words, these roles and this task and the pursuit of vanity did not just happen, but it was implanted within the design of creation, and man is a part of that creation by someone who had a design for man and the entirety of his creation. God gave this task to men. So this world, which seems to be so purposeless and seems to be going nowhere at a rapid rate, standing outside and above that is someone called God, and that one who stands outside and above his creation is involved in his creation, and it does things with a purpose. He's not just other, he's not just out there, he's not just a figurehead, he's not just a mythological sense of something. He's involved in his creation. God has given a task to the sons of men, and this task is so pervasive as to be identified with this theme of creation, of vanity. All is vanity, and God has given that as man's task. So we're asking the question, what actions does God take? God has given. I mean, this is very significant. Very, very important. In a book that talks about chasing after the wind, that talks about vanity, that talks about the purposelessness of life, there is a God who has a purpose for all this seething mass of movement. And God has given. God has formulated purposes for men. God has given this task to the sons of men. Well, I want to say more, we'll never get done. But that's the point. And I take a minute to say that because it's a recurring theme. Any comments on that? You see where I'm going, or is that a big cloud or something?
It seems to me that even though everything that we see on this earth is empty and vain, there is a purpose beyond it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And God has given us this burdensome, vain task, and yet there is something beyond it that is not vain.
Right. Not and that injects meaning into everything that seems so meaningless. It's a whole different view of reality. It's a whole different view of life. The non-Christian and the Christian view life entirely differently. Because God has given. I mean, that's the difference. Okay, the next reference to God. Somebody know where that is? Lucas. 2:24 through 26. Want to read that, please?
There's nothing better for a man that he should eat and drink and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can taste and hear unto more than I? For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he giveth travail, to gather and to keep up, that he may give to him that is good before God.
There's several things there, but a couple themes are really paramount. What are the actions that God takes that you see in that passage, Lucas?
He gives to man
who enjoys
the pleasures of his labor.
Right. So the ability that we have to derive pleasure from what we do and a job well done. And so on, comes from God. That's the gift of God that God has given. We also see here it says it's from the hand of God. Same thing, right? Hand of God gives. Any other things you want to notice from that passage that God does?
He gives wisdom.
Okay, God gives wisdom.
Wisdom, knowledge, and joy.
It's quite a package. It's good. Again, God gives. Bob?
He also discerns between those who are good in his sight and the sinner.
Right, and so that's kind of a minor theme, and this will be a major theme in some subsequent passages. But so hang on to that. God, there's a difference between good and bad, and God sees them, and later on we'll see that God will reward them, but there's a difference in the way that God views men and their actions and their intents. Did someone else have something? Yep.
I would say that in a sense, without God or without understanding God, you can't find the enjoyment or the pleasure in those very same things that he's given.
I guess not. Absolutely not.
From a Christian perspective, we find joy even in suffering, like Paul and Peter said, hey, they rejoice that they were able to suffer for the Lord. Well, if they didn't know the Lord, their suffering, they couldn't have found any pleasure. And it's the same thing. And he says, I've seen who can eat and who can have enjoyment without it.
Right. Now, there is pleasure and joy, and legitimately so, in many areas of creation. So, Christians, non-Christians can experience joy and fulfillment because God's made it that way. God has given it to the sons of men, not just to Christians. And they can find happiness in marriage and happiness in love and happiness in work and happiness in fulfillment and accomplishment of their ambitions. But the whole picture, the gestalt of the thing, is meaningless without God. The missing link, because he's set eternity in their hearts, and apart from that, it doesn't hang together. The meaning is missing. Well, let's keep going here. Next passage. 3 verses 10 and 11. Could you read that, please? Okay. And what do we see here in terms of God's actions? Another God is given, right? So, I mean, we could just keep notching them up here. What else? In verse 11 there? He has made everything, and then what does it say?
Appropriate
to its time. So God is the creator, yes, but God is the creator with a purpose, and everything that he has made fits. And so he has made everything appropriate to its time. Now, that's a reference back, you see, to verses 2 through 8. And so every part of creation and human activity was made by God, first of all. He has made everything. But it has a time and it fits. And you have to really sit back and think about that. We'll come back to that as we move through the book. But he has made everything appropriate to its time. So in other words, that's a different view of life. Instead of saying, you're going to die, it's your time. That's a godless statement. Now, it's a true statement, but it doesn't recognize God. It's just, well, you're going to die. It's your time. And you're going to graduate from college, and that's wonderful. And you know, some bad things happen to you, and well, that's just the way it goes. That's a time to kill, a time to, you know, that's what it's saying in 3, 2 through 8. That's a non-God view. But that's not what, in verse 11 he says, he has made everything appropriate in its time. It's part of the design of the Creator, and that it all fits together. another important statement here in 3:11.
Second part of verse 11.
Yep.
That's
huge, I think. He has set eternity in their hearts. What's that mean?
I believe it would mean that he has given to every man an understanding of his mortality and the reality of eternity.
Absolutely. It's the God-sized hole that Augustine spoke of. It's the hunger for meaning and connection to the ultimate that philosophers speak of. Scripture says he has also set eternity in their heart. That's interesting. Here's my heart. And this infinity is encapsulated in here, such that until I connect to that, I'm wandering, I'm hungering, I'm lost. He has set eternity in their hearts. That's an action of God. And that's why, boy, it's tough to do this in half an hour. And that's why, in Romans 1, when men turn their back on truth that's revealed, such as this, and eagerly pursue sin, they have to do something, and it's called suppress the truth. Because eternity is set in their hearts, and they don't want to listen. They don't want to hear that voice, because sin is very uncomfortable then. And that's why truth must be suppressed. The inner voice must be shut down somehow so that they can sin with abandon. Well, he has set eternity in their hearts. That's the action of God. Next occurrence of God here. Don't have to look far. 13 through 15. I'll read that. Moreover, every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. There it is again, the gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God is so worked that men should fear him. That which is, has been already, and that which will be, has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. What actions of God do we see here? Yes.
Basically, it's providential ruling of everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In fact, the other verse that we just called over, it's not only God of creation, he's God of providence.
Right. Good, good. I agree. In generalities, what are the couple phrases, though, that it uses? Because words are important. Yes. Okay. The first one was God's gift, and we noted that in whatever it was here, 3:13. What do you see in verses 14 and 15?
God does
God does. And what does God do? Why is that significant? Hugely important. It's a massive contrast to what he's saying, isn't it? Vanity, poof, but what God does remains forever. Or, you look in chapter 2 and you talk about all the works that Solomon did. He built this and he built that and he had this and he had that. And he's going to die and nobody remembers and all that stuff. But what God does, everything that God does, remains forever. And God's involved in His creation, and He's involved in your life. And what God does remains forever. You looking for meaning? You looking for lasting significance? Connect to God. Because everything God does remains forever. Yes?
Well, it's basically getting rid of the idea that there's a secular and a spiritual realm. God's involved in all of it. And there's no part of my life that I can take apart and say, you know what? Forget what God says, I'm going to do this. There's no section of my life that I can do something that God hasn't put in the plan.
Well, I think that's the essence of Ecclesiastes, right? Life under the sun is the ultimate secular viewpoint. And what he's saying in 50 different ways is, no way, Jose, God is interlaced in it all in every way you slice it. You know. We also see that God has so worked that men should fear him. And we could talk about that, but God's works in creation, in shall we say, the positive ways and the negative ways, make an impact on humanity so that man's response is required and expected and natural. So God does stuff in your life. He blesses you and He takes away. He makes you go through the time to weep and the time to laugh, the time to mourn and the time to dance. And in each of those situations, God does it so that men would fear Him. He's involved in your life. He's involved in the lives of men because these involvements expect a response from man. A response is natural. What do I do when I mourn? I look for comfort. Where do you look for comfort? And so on. God's actions. All right, next passage. It's not far again, verses 17 and 18. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man, for a time for every matter and for every deed is there. I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them. Relate that to judge again, the preceding verse. In order for them to see that they are but beasts. So what does God do in verses 17 and 18? What's the tense of the verb in verse 17? That's right. Future. God will judge. Is this important? Yeah, to the whole thing about Ecclesiastes? Yeah, supremely important. Supremely important. Why?
In a sense, it gives us an understanding that we need to be very mindful of what we do and what we say and how we act and respond to all that God has given.
Absolutely. More. Tell me more. Right. So,
In verse 15, it says God requires account of what is past.
Yeah.
And here, God is looking forward to that time when that will be required. requires a judgment of what has been done.
Right. So life under the sun, life apart from God, really isn't. Well, what's that mean? It means a lot of things, but one really, really big thing, it means that God is watching, God is evolving, God will hold men accountable. God will judge. This is it. This is all you got to know. God will judge. If you didn't take anything else away to flavor the secularist viewpoint of the book of Ecclesiastes, this would be enough. God will judge. There will be an accounting. Now, that's important in many, many ways. One is that God is not blind. There is a difference, and He cares. And there's a lot of injustice in the world. Doesn't God care? Yeah, God will judge. He'll make things right, both for the oppressed and the oppressor. What about those who seek God and serve Him all their lives and receive little in this life of happiness and joy? That may be an overstatement. To their current perception, that is the way that it is. Well, God will judge. God will judge. And He'll reward those who seek Him, and He'll reward those who don't. And that makes all the difference in terms of every choice that I make every day. Every action, every thought, every intent, every word will be judged, and therefore it's injected with meaning. Wait a minute, I thought I could just say this and nobody heard and nobody whatever and it didn't matter. Well, it did matter. God will judge. It did matter. What you said, what you thought, and what you did, though unseen by any man, matters because God will judge. He'll bring every thought, both seen and unseen, into judgment. That's what it says. For a time, for every matter, verse 17, and for every deed is there. God will judge both righteous and the wicked. Both sides are significant in terms of God's judgment. So this is hugely important. This theme recurs. We're not going to have time to go through all of these passages, but this one recurs, and you can see why it does. God will judge. Well, then in verse 18, it's interesting, you have this present tense of judgment, and I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. What's that mean?
Humble.
He humbles them. How do? How? What?
By testing them, by making them go through trials.
Right.
That shows him that he's just a creature.
Right.
And that he is not that
important. Right. Right. So before I was tried, I thought I was something. I go through this thing and I fail. And there's a lot of ways to fail. And I've done quite a few of them. And God is testing. He's showing me something. And there's so many ways this applies in our lives, right? I'm going to do this. I'm going to be that. I can do this on my own. And God takes us through something and we're just shown to be. And God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. The point is, life, it's not life under the sun apart from God. God's involved in my life, and He's deflating me from time to time in order for me to get a sense of reality, therefore to know my need of Him and His strength and His guidance and His all of that. And again, God's action in this life. Well, let me summarize the remainder of these passages in chapter, and you might want to look at these with this viewpoint that we've put forward here, but chapter 5, verse 6, why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? Again, this concept of judgment. Chapter 5:19, God has empowered him to eat, to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. Kind of the same thing, kind of God gives a kind of a step beyond that. Chapter 7, verse 13, let's look at that for just a second. Consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not discover anything that will be after him. So why do things in your life go wrong? Because God bent them instead of leaving them straight. It's not an accident. It's not a freak occurrence. It's not the way it goes. God bent them. And why did he do that? Well, there's a lot of reasons. And many of them are inscrutable. God has made the one as well as the other so that man may not discover anything that will be after him. It's to leave us questioning and seeking God. Among other reasons. It's the work of God so that men may seek him. Again, what are the actions of God? He's involved in your life. He's involved in his earth. Chapter 7, verse 29, God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. God's creation. And chapter 11, verse 9, God will bring you to judgment. Chapter 12, verse 14, God will bring every act to judgment. So because we had to hasten here, the terms used for God, it's God all the way through, plus personal pronouns. In chapter 12, we encounter God as shepherd and God as, creator. So creator and then shepherd as providence. Let's step back from this and talk about the roles or views of God. What is, from these things that we've discussed, these actions that God takes, how does the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes view God? Who is God and what is he doing with respect to his creation?
I would think that he takes a stand that he views God as sovereign. In control of everything.
Yes, very important. Not removed, but in control. Were you going to say more? Okay. That was good. That was very important. Yes, John?
He provides blessings in this life, or maybe simple things like work or food or clothing, things like that. Mm-hmm. Those things are not provided.
It's very important. God is so gracious that even for men who are in rebellion against them, he fills their lives full of goodness. You see the happiness that men who do not serve God experience? Great happiness and all of that are the good gifts of God. He does not begrudge to fill their lives full of fulfillment and happiness. Now, ultimately, there is more. They need more, but he does not. God is so gracious. He fills their cups to overflowing. Though they spit in his face, they don't recognize his reality. What else?
Two things I see. One is that God is involved.
Yes.
He's not detached, but he is involved, even in the little things. And also that he has a purpose.
Yeah. And these are two are huge. With respect to this, what the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, life under the sun, the meaninglessness of life, chasing after the wind. But throughout the book, he's talking about God as being involved in his creation. It's really not life under the sun, apart from God. And God has a purpose in all of this that he's working. It's not just vanity. Despite what you see and experience. And God will judge. Very important theme. So what is the role of God? And God is exalted and holy. And we didn't have a chance to look at that verse closely. But before whom we should not speak or vow carelessly. And that's related to the whole business of God being judge. So, God is everywhere, according to the book of Ecclesiastes. Involved in all aspects of man's life and human affairs. Man is accountable to God, for God is the judge. And God designed man with purpose. God gives men opportunity, pursuits, and rewards throughout his life. You know, in a sense, he says all this about life under the sun. It's almost tongue-in-cheek, and I don't know that that's appropriate because it's not tongue-in-cheek. Because all throughout this book, as he's talking about life under the sun, he subversively refers to God. Right? He's got this purpose and method, and he's just sticking these references to God in throughout the book. And every time he does, it runs counter to the whole message. Life under the sun. Life is meaningless. You hear an echo of that in your own life. God gives. God will hold you accountable. God will judge. Each of those is subversive to the announced intent of showing the meaninglessness of life. Well, it's not subversive because it answers the true purpose and underlying viewpoint of the writer to show you that though you feel this way and though you see that, it's to drive you to God to find answers, connections, purpose, and meaning. So I find the way that he refers to God is to being so centering as you go through the book and try to say, where is he coming from? I think that helps things get aligned as to how he can ask the questions he asks and still be a Christian. Any questions? Any comments? Bob? For sure. And he's subtle. Very subtle. Very subtle. Little specks. Pregnant with meaning. But exactly. That's exactly what he's doing. He is not academic. He is not... Sorry, Eric. He's for real. He's for real. Yeah, well, I don't... The comment will come when we hit this, because we're out of time. But yeah, I don't think we're saying exactly what you're saying there, that no one's truly happy. What I'm saying is exactly the opposite of that. And that's what the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying. There is much happiness in this world to be experienced apart from God. Now, that happiness, which is experienced apart from God, came from the hand of God. That's exactly what he's trying to say. Saying you may be blind to it, but that's the deal. And he's saying the best thing you can do is to wear white all the time and enjoy life with the woman that you love and so on. Meaning, if you don't recognize God, that's the best you can do, but that's true happiness. And yet, in it all, there is these missing parts, the missing whole. And that's where the whole business of suppressing the truth and all that comes in. So that's a fragmented answer. And let's treat that when we move through the book. But I think what you're saying is not exactly the same, that everybody out there isn't happy. No, it's not at all what we're saying. It's not what the writer of Ecclesiastes... I think the book of Ecclesiastes is the best answer to that question that I've ever read. That men experience a lot of joy and fulfillment, and God designed it to be so, apart from God. And yet, throughout it all, God has given, and God will judge, and God has set eternity in their hearts, and so on. And the ultimate connections and meaning and purpose and satisfaction eludes man. That's why it's the chasing after the wind. And at the end of the day, people say, what was the point of my life? And it's that point. So they live for 30 years and they sit down one evening and they say, oh boy, this moment of realization comes upon them. And that's what this is about.